This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Dozens of civilians have been killed, hundreds more injured in the ongoing fighting between Sudanese government troops and paramilitary fighters known as the Rapid Support Forces. Reuters correspondent Matthew LaRotunda reports.
The pitched battles across Sudan, pitting government troops against the paramilitary outfit known as the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, is continuing the threat of spiraling into a wider civil war. Scores of civilians have been killed and hundreds injured, according to a doctors' union.
Come close.
And on the streets of the city, civilians are describing scenes of chaos as they struggle to source even basic necessities such as water or medicine. The UN World Food Program says it's been forced to halt operations in several areas, and three employees were killed.
That is Reuters' Matthew LaRotunda reporting. The White House has called for an immediate ceasefire to the fighting in Sudan. Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston tells us more.
Western powers, including the U.S., had swung behind a transition towards democratic elections following the overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. After a military coup in 2021, they suspended financial support and backed a plan for a new transition and a civilian government. Western powers also fear the potential for a Russian base on the Red Sea, which Sudanese military leaders have expressed openness to.
And meanwhile, a Russian court has convicted top opposition figure Vladimir Kara-Murza Jr. of treason for publicly denouncing Moscow's war in Ukraine and sentenced him to 25 years in prison. It was the latest move on the Kremlin's crackdown on anyone who dares to criticize the invasion. This is VOA News. A secret Chinese police outpost has been revealed in New York. AP correspondent Shelley Adler.
The Justice Department says two men have been arrested on charges that they helped establish a secret police outpost in New York City on behalf of the Chinese government. Officials separately announced charges against more than three dozen members of China's National Police, accusing them of creating and using fake social media accounts to locate and harass dissidents in the U.S. The cases are part of a series of Justice Department prosecutions aimed at disrupting Chinese government efforts to target Chinese dissidents, including those promoting pro-democracy views. I'm Shelley Adler.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov traveled to the Brazilian capital Monday and expressed gratitude for Brazil's push for an end to hostilities in Ukraine, even as that same effort has irked both Kyiv and the West. And by afternoon, had prompted an unusually sharp rebuke from the White House. Lula da Silva has refused to provide weapons to Ukraine while proposing a club of nations, including Brazil and China, to mediate peace. Following the meeting, the spokesperson for the White House's National Security Council blasted Brazil's approach to the war and said officials are parroting Russian and Chinese propaganda without at all looking at all the facts. A guardsman applied to be a hitman, but the job ad was actually a joke. We get details from AP correspondent Lisa Dwyer.
Tennessee Air National Guardsman has been arrested after federal agents say he responded to a parody website promoting jobs for hitmen. Josiah Garcia submitted an employment application February 16th to the website rentahitman.com and sent several follow-up emails over the next month that included his name, address, phone number, date of birth, and a photo of his Tennessee driver's license. An undercover agent provided Garcia with a fictional target package and $2,500. Garcia was arrested the same day. Garcia later said that he had not intended to go through with it and that he intended to take a job offer at a national medical center instead. If convicted, he faces up to 10 years in prison. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is pledging to pass legislation to raise the nation's debt ceiling, but only if coupled with a cap on future federal spending. Voting could come as soon as next week. In a speech Monday at the New York Stock Exchange, the Republican leader lashed out at President Joe Biden for refusing to engage in budget-cutting negotiations to prevent a debt crisis. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Thank you. 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Gino Ruffo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine prepares for its offensive as the Battle of Bakhmut spreads to another city.
In the past week, at least three people have died in Chasiv-Yar, Ukraine, and city workers say deaths and bombings are now regular occurrences.
Dozens killed as clashes continue in Sudan amid calls for peace.
The military headquarters, Khartoum International Airport, and areas around the presidential palace are the current main battlefields between the military and the rapid support forces.
And the United States and more than 40 countries protest Russia's arrest of a journalist. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. A top Ukrainian official said Monday that Ukraine will launch its counteroffensive against Russian troops when it's ready, adding that it's only a matter of time before the country achieves the necessary level of military preparedness to do so. Oleksiy Danilov, the secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, told the Associated Press in an interview in Kyiv that Ukraine's allies are helping the government to achieve the level of technical equipment necessary to launch the attack, delivering heavy armored vehicles and ammunition. This as the Battle of Bakhmut rages. VOA traveled to Chasiv-Yar, a city next to Bakhmut, the longest and bloodiest battle in this war. Experts say Chasiv-Yar is now half surrounded by Russian forces. VOA's Heather Murdock has the report.
In the past week, at least three people have died in Chasiv-Yar, Ukraine, and city workers say deaths and bombings are now regular occurrences. They say their main job now is to convince people who are still here to evacuate the city. This is Yevgeny Dmitriev, city administrator.
Many people have already left, and some humanitarian aid is still here. We want to move this humanitarian aid from here to a safer place.
Shelters here are called invincibility points, providing electricity to charge phones and internet access. About 20% of the population remains in Chasiv-Yar, but most of the city services are not operating. On every block, homes and businesses are damaged or destroyed. Here's Alexander, a Chasiv-Yar resident.
It was damaged. The windows were blown out. Yes, mostly the windows blown out. We cover them with plastic tarps. We cover them and life goes on.
Chasiv-Yar is about 10 kilometers from the city of Bakhmut, where the longest and deadliest battle in Ukraine is currently taking place. Most observers, like journalists and aid workers, haven't been inside Bakhmut for more than a month. At that time, civilians were barely surviving on donated food and water in basements and shelters. As aid workers deliver food and water to the invincibility point in Chasiv-Yar, they say this city looks eerily similar to what Bakhmut looked like a month or two ago. On the streets of Chasiv-Yar, we meet Alexander Serkovich, who leads the aid organization Peace and Kindness Fund.
This city is heavily damaged now. The last time we were here, it was in one piece, about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Ukraine says it plans to launch a massive counteroffensive this spring after winter battles that have killed many resulted in few advances for either side. Heather Murdock, VOA News, Chasiv-Yar, Ukraine.
The United States and more than 40 other countries said in a joint statement on Monday that they are deeply concerned over Russia's detainment of a Wall Street Journal reporter and protested Moscow's, quote, efforts to limit and intimidate the media, unquote. U.S. Representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
Free, independent, and pluralistic media play an indispensable role in informing people around the world. We note the widespread outcry from both Russia and international journalists in response to this recent arrest, including an open letter signed by dozens of prominent independent media figures from Russia that calls the case against them preposterous and unjust. We will continue to advocate for press freedom and the safety of journalists worldwide. We urge Russian Federation authorities to release those they hold on political grounds and to end the draconian crackdown on freedom of expression, including against members of the media.
That's U.S. Representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. A third day of fighting between Sudan's military and paramilitary rapid support forces raged Monday in the capital, with both sides claiming control of strategic sites. A doctors' union said nearly 200 people have been killed in the clashes as calls for a ceasefire are growing. Michael Latit reports from Khartoum.
The sounds of gunfire echoed across the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, and other towns Monday afternoon. The military headquarters, Khartoum International Airport, and areas around the presidential palace are the current main battlefields between the military and the rapid support forces. The shooting affected the power supply and water system in the capital, making life more difficult for those trapped indoors by the fighting and people wounded in the clashes. In the Kalakla neighborhood south of Khartoum, the situation seems to be relatively calm, and people venture out to get basic necessities. Wissal Muhammad, a mother of three, says this is the first time in 3 days she's coming out to get food for her children. She says the situation is difficult and we are stranded. There is no electricity and power, and we cannot be mobile if there is an emergency. We are approaching the festivity time and people are just indoors. The fighting started on Saturday morning, and Sudanese doctors say nearly 100 people have been killed and several others injured, including civilians, during the past 3 days. Hamid Babikir sells vegetables along the Jebel Awliya highway south of Khartoum. He told VOA that he is unable to order more stock from the central market due to the tense situation. He says roads are blocked and we cannot risk going out to get vegetables. What I am selling today is a leftover from yesterday. Everybody keeps on complaining of the tense situation and increase in prices because of a lack of fuel. Al-Mois Hassan is a grocer in the Abu Adam neighborhood south of Khartoum. He says he is worried about the robbery and has only partially opened his shop as a protection. He called on the warring parties to put the interests of the country and civilians as the first priority. He says the fighting has affected all the shops, not only mine. I'm not afraid of anything rather than losing lives. The two who are fighting are all Sudanese and are only following orders. We hope that God will change their hearts. The military said this afternoon that they had restored control over the state-run TV and radio, which was taken over by the RSF yesterday. The East African Regional Bloc, IGAD, has delegated the presidents of South Sudan, Kenya, and Djibouti to talk to the Sudanese warring parties in an effort to halt the fighting. Michael Latit for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
Thank you, Michael. And the East African Regional Bloc, IGAD, says the presidents of South Sudan, Kenya, and Djibouti will travel to Sudan in an effort to broker and mediate ceasefires. Fighting between rival military forces rages in Khartoum. VOA's Mariama Diallo has the story from Nairobi.
As Sudan was rocked by fighting for the third day in a row, IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, said Kenyan President William Ruto, South Sudanese President Salva Kiir, and Djibouti's President Ismail Omar Gele will go to Khartoum in an effort to broker an immediate ceasefire. Nur Mohammed Sheikh is spokesperson for IGAD's executive secretary. He talked to VOA via WhatsApp.
President Salva Kiir, who has been in touch already with both General Burhan and General Hebeti to convey the message of the summit yesterday. And so now they are just preparations is underway for them to undertake this mission.
This comes after IGAD called for an immediate and unconditional cessation of hostilities between the warring parties in Sudan during an emergency virtual session of heads of states and government on Sunday. Sheikh told VOA.
They must stop fighting in civilian inhabited areas and open humanitarian corridors. So they constituted a committee of three heads of states who are highly experienced knowledgeable on the Sudan situation to undertake a mission to visit Khartoum and reach out to all the Sudanese stakeholders to make sure that, you know, there is a cessation of hostilities and the parties return to dialogue.
Sheikh said the conflict undermines the peace process achieved over the last 4 months. He added that East African countries are closely linked, so any outbreak of violence in one country has security, economic, social, and humanitarian implications for its neighbors. Fighting broke out on Saturday in the Sudanese capital Khartoum between the Sudan Armed Forces Unit, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, head of Sudan's Transitional Governing Sovereign Council, and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, led by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemedti, who is deputy head of the council. The clashes have so far left nearly 100 people dead and 600 injured, according to the International Rescue Committee, which has since stopped its operations in most parts of the country. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigerian lawmakers are investigating allegations of $2.4 billion in illegal sales of stolen oil to China. Nigerian authorities say they have struggled to halt the loss of billions of dollars a year in oil theft. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
The House of Representatives Ad Hoc Committee on Oil Theft resumed its probe on the unofficial sales in 2015 of 48 million barrels of crude oil to China. Lawmakers were tipped off about the deal by a whistleblower in July 2020. The whistleblower alleged that the stolen crude had been stored at several Chinese ports and later sold by Nigeria's national oil company NNPC Limited officials. NNPC Limited denies the allegation and called it false. Chinese authorities have not responded. This week, Nigeria's finance minister, attorney general, and other top cabinet members did not appear for interrogation on the matter at a hearing. The committee says that could delay the investigation. Faith Nwadishi is the executive director of the Center for Transparency Advocacy.
48 million barrels of crude taken out of the country is almost equivalent to about 50 days oil production or less. We don't really have strong structures and systems in place. It's really not the first time it's going to happen, and I don't think it's the last time it's going to happen until we get our structures right. If the legislative arm invites any person to an office and the person doesn't have any cogent reason to appear, it is grounds enough for the person's resignation.
The House committee also raised concerns about irregularities in the figures of crude oil sales between 2011 and 2015 and said it will investigate. Crude oil accounts for more than 90% of Nigeria's revenue, and Nigerian authorities have been trying to stem oil theft for decades. Officials say the country loses $700 million every month as a result. Last year, President Muhammadu Buhari said the trend was putting the country's economy in a precarious situation. Emmanuel Afimia, head of an Abuja-based oil and gas consulting firm, says corruption is the reason oil theft has persisted in Nigeria.
Corruption has been the main factor that has hindered the growth of the sector. If the country is actually serious about stopping oil theft, corruption has to be completely eliminated. You have to address corruption from the highest office of this country.
Last year, Nigerian authorities awarded a controversial contract to 10 Titas Security Services, an oil pipeline surveillance team headed by an ex-Niger Delta militia group, in an effort to address oil theft issues. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
In other news, Israeli President Isaac Herzog called for national unity at the opening ceremony of Israel's annual Holocaust Memorial Day on Monday, as the nation remains deeply divided over plans by the far-right government to implement an overhaul of the judiciary. The president's office has been engaged in talks between Israel opposition members to broker a compromise with the governing coalition over planned judicial changes, which will see Israel's highest court stripped of much of its power. The proposal will give the government effective control over the appointment of Supreme Court judges and allow Parliament to overrule many decisions of the court. The potential move has also caused one of the biggest domestic crises in Israel's recent history. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Junior Duofo in Washington. Climate change is expected to be the main focus of a large New Zealand delegation's tour of the Pacific. New Zealand's Deputy Prime Minister Kamel Sopuloni is the Solomon's Island Monday and has downplayed tensions between China and the West as she begins a five-day trip to the region. Last year, the Solomon Islands signed a controversial security pact with Beijing. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
New Zealand considers the Pacific its traditional sphere of influence. The region is also of great strategic importance for Australia, the United States, and China. All three countries have recently made efforts to boost their goals in the Pacific. In September 2022, the US held a summit with Pacific Island leaders, while China has sought to expand its diplomatic, military, and trade ambitions in the region. The New Zealand government has sent a 50-strong delegation on a five-day, three-nation tour of the region, starting Monday in Solomon Islands, a mostly Melanesian chain of islands northeast of Australia. Last year, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare signed a security pact with China that caused alarm in Washington, Canberra, and Wellington. New Zealand Deputy Prime Minister Carmel Sepuloni has tried to downplay regional tensions with China, preferring instead to focus on other concerns, including climate change. Sepuloni told Radio New Zealand's Morning Reports programme that consolidating her country's place in the region was a priority.
I think what needs to be our focus is New Zealand's relationship with the Pacific. This is our key relationship. The Pacific region is a priority, and make sure that that's as strong as can be possible. And that's certainly what we're here to do on this mission.
China and Taiwan also compete for influence in the Pacific Islands, where four of Taiwan's 13 diplomatic allies are located. They are Palau, the Marshall Islands, Tuvalu and Nauru. Kiribati and Solomon Islands cut diplomatic ties with Taipei in favour of Beijing in 2019 after Chinese offers of aid. Australia has intensified its efforts in the region in the past year since the election of a centre-left government in Canberra. New Zealand Deputy Prime Minister Sepuloni's regional tour this week also includes Tonga and Fiji. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency launched its Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, or JUICE, spacecraft from its Guiana Space Center on Friday, April 14th. According to ESA's JUICE website, the spacecraft is slated to make comprehensive examinations of the solar system's largest planet, as well as its three largest ocean moons, Ganymede, Callisto, and Europa. JUICE, which will use gravity assist to propel it through space, is set to orbit the Jupiter system in July 2031. Since the gas giant planet was discovered by legendary astronomer Galileo Galilei in 1610, the spacecraft carries a commemorative plaque to honor his discoveries. As of now, the JUICE mission will end in September 2035, when the spacecraft will be intentionally crashed into Ganymede. But ESA could also elect to extend the mission. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
It really was powerful because it showed what is possible when men and women band together and say enough is enough.
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation. Each week, right here on The Voice of America. on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossings, where we feature music and interviews along with your favorite artists from around the world. Tune in and interact live with us here in Washington, D.C.
Hello, Shirin.
Hello, Larry. How are you?
Good. How are you tonight?
Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT.
Stay tuned every Wednesday and Friday at 9 p.m. UTC time with your pilot, Roger Moon, to listen to the RM Show, where you can respond to our question of the week, get some entertainment news, and enjoy some great music. It's all happening at VOA Africa. God bless. Peace, Africa.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Gina Duff in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently held an event at the State Department thanking the diplomats, other government workers, and volunteers who made it possible for the 222 political prisoners released by Nicaragua's Ortega regime in February to start their new life in the United States. That work began in large part with our colleagues in Embassy Managua, who negotiated with the Nicaraguan government, said Secretary Blinken. Later, hundreds of government colleagues, NGOs, and volunteers took over.
You provided them with food, with clothing, with health care. You helped them through the jarring process of starting a new life far from their homes and their communities.
Secretary Blinken noted that the 222 Nicaraguan prisoners, doctors, political leaders, priests, and others, were connected by one overriding aspiration.
And that was to simply exercise their fundamental freedoms and to try to safeguard the freedom of their fellow citizens. Tragically, in Ortega's Nicaragua, that's a crime.
Also, tragically, not all who tried to safeguard the freedom of their fellow citizens were able or willing to leave Nicaragua that February day. One notable example is the Bishop of Matagalpa, Rolando Alvarez, one of the country's most vocal Catholic leaders who ran afoul of Ortega by advocating for human rights. Under house arrest since August, Alvarez refused to leave Nicaragua on the plane. The next day, he was taken to La Modelo prison and is serving a 26-year sentence for treason. In March, the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights called on the Ortega regime to release Bishop Alvarez and other political prisoners still held in Nicaragua. The United States has repeatedly called for Bishop Alvarez's release. As Secretary of State Blinken said, we will join our partners across the hemisphere and around the world to continue to push for a return to democracy and respect for human rights in Nicaragua, while also using all of the diplomatic and economic tools that we have to promote accountability for the widespread abuses from the regime.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.